All right. How about Miranda? Well, thank you so much for having us tonight. It's definitely a blessing to be here and to get reacquainted with Dennis. It's been many years since we saw each other. We were talking about how long ago that would have been. About a quarter century ago, but neither one of us really want to be reminded that that much time has passed. Well, are you guys ready for a Bible study? Yeah. All right, so before I even tell you where to turn, can I start by asking you a question? If you were a superhero, what superpower would you want to have? Like, would you want to have flight? Would you want to have invisibility? Would you want to have super strength? See, I think about these things sometimes. Like I think about the costume. I'd want a really cool logo on the chest. I guess I'm wearing my costume tonight. And I'd want like a cool mask or helmet or both, right? Don't forget about a secret identity. I mean, that is so cool when a superhero has a secret identity. Like, you know, Bruce Parker, Tony Stark. One of those would be really, really cool, right? And let's not forget the base or the headquarters. Like what if you had your own Batcave or your own Fortress of Solitude? How amazing would that be? Were you into superheroes when you were a kid? I mean, I have to admit, I was. I like to watch superhero cartoons on TV. I like to read superhero comic books. And sometimes, if I'm keeping it real, I even like to pretend that I was a superhero. Now, kids today have so got it made. Our daughter, Odessa, we call her Dez, she has to pass a lot of hours on the road. I think Miranda mentioned that we're on the road most of the year this year, like 9 months on the road. We'll eventually get to Maine and all the way to Florida and then back across the southern states. So that's a lot of hours that Dez passes with her iPad. With an iPad or kids and their gaming systems or even their mobile phones. I mean, it's like they're never more than one click away from being able to pretend to be almost anyone or to do almost anything. But when I was a kid, if I wanted to play a superhero, Mom did not hand me an iPad. She handed me a tattered old bath towel and a safety pin. And I'd wrap that towel around my shoulders and I'd cinch it up under my chin. Mom would help me get it pinned and hours of fun would follow. Now, kids today would get like 5 minutes out of that, and the first four would be spent complaining about how lame it was. But we could make it work all day, right? Isn't it true, though, that even as adults, I think there's something inside of us that still wants to be heroic? Isn't there something somewhere inside of you that wants to do something heroic, that wants to live heroically? That's what we're going to talk about. So if you brought your Bible, it looks like all of you guys did. That's good. Let's turn to Joshua chapter 2. There, we will meet a woman who totally learned to live heroically, who did something heroic, who was a hero. And so even as you're finding your place in Joshua 2, I'm going to pray. Father, speak to us through this chapter, through this story. Lord, thank you so much for recording this story for us. Thank you for your word. Thank you that it's just that it's your word. But not only have you given us your word in the Bible, you're here tonight. Thank you for being present. Thank you for your power in this place. Thank you that you're speaking to us even now. I pray that you would speak to me. I pray that you would speak through me. I pray that each one of us would hear your voice and be open to receive what you have for us tonight. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Well, so several lessons that we're going to learn from this woman we're about to meet about how we too can live heroically. The first of those, if we're going to live heroically, we have to let go of the past. So look with me at verse 1. It says, "Now Joshua the son of Nun sent out two men from Acacia Grove to spy secretly, saying, 'Go, view the land, especially Jericho.' So they went and came to the house of a harlot named Rahab and lodged there." Now this is a generation after the Exodus. If you haven't read the book, you've seen the movie, right? The Ten Commandments of Charlton Heston, or maybe you went the animated route and you saw The Prince of Egypt. The point would be that this story takes place after that story. So Joshua has succeeded Moses. The people have crossed the river. They're ready now to conquer the land that God has promised to them when they come to this place called Acacia Grove. Now, if Acacia Grove sounds familiar, it should. It was there just a generation before that the men of Israel, their fathers, were seduced by the women of Moab. And so, long story short, as a result of their unfaithfulness to God and their unfaithfulness to their families, 24,000 people died. Which means that for many, they were going forward without a husband, or for others, it was going forward without a father or without a son. For still others, it was going forward without a brother or going forward without an uncle or a nephew. And you know that every year on an anniversary, they would be reminded. You know that every year on a birthday, they would be reminded. And you know that on this occasion, as they gathered in this place, that they would be reminded how one generation's choices affect the next. I mean, it makes me think about how my parents' choices have affected me. And it makes me think about how the choices that I'm making are affecting my children. I have an adult daughter and a 10-year-old daughter and now a granddaughter. That's right, you're looking at a newly minted Grandpa and Mimi. We have a 6-month-old granddaughter in Tallahassee, Florida. And if you're wondering whether this tour is routed through Florida, of course it is. We'll spend about a month in the Florida area and get as many visits as we can with our granddaughter. But it makes me think, this story does, about how my choices are affecting, you know, even her. Maybe your family isn't so different from mine. You know, maybe in your family there has been something that has happened over and over and over again. You know, like something harmful, something hurtful that has recurred generation after generation. In my family, on my dad's side, that's been alcoholism. My dad was an alcoholic. Now, if he were here tonight, he would probably describe himself as a recovering alcoholic, just because that's the language that lots of people use. But my dad's been sober for many years now, and I'm so proud of him. I mean, his alcohol abuse cost him his marriage to my mother. And his alcohol abuse very nearly cost him his second marriage. He was separated for a long period of time. But my dad did get sober. And I can't even begin to tell you like how much better his quality of life is since he got sober. Really, really proud of him. But it wasn't just my dad, it was his dad. My grandfather was an alcoholic. It's kind of funny for me when I talk about him like this because I can barely even see his face. Like right now as I try to picture him, I really don't even have a definite picture of him in my mind. I could probably count on one hand the number of times that I saw him in my life, and it wasn't because there was no opportunity. In fact, he lived well into my adulthood, but he was kind of alienated from the family. I mean, it's true that he had a fear of flying that made that even more difficult for him, but there's no question in my mind that there was this gulf between us that didn't have to be there. And that's because, again, you know, of his alcoholism and what that cost him. He and my grandmother were married and divorced twice to each other. They were married, they got divorced, they tried it again, they got divorced again, and no doubt in large part due to his alcoholism. So think about, you know, how that affected my dad. I mean, for my dad, that meant growing up largely without a father figure in the home. And for my dad, that meant growing up largely in poverty. He and his brothers, my uncles, lived with their mother, my grandmother, who lived with her mother, my great-grandmother, in public housing in San Bernardino, California, Waterman Gardens. And you know that had to impact the way that my dad raised me and my sister. You know, my grandfather has since passed away. And it's been some time now, I'm not even sure how many years, but soon after, I mean like months later, I was in California attending one of our pastor's conferences, and I got to spend an afternoon with my dad after the conference had ended. So my dad was telling me about just months before having traveled to Stockton, California, where my grandfather lived his final years and having gone through his personal belongings. And so my dad asked me to wait while he went in the other room. And when my dad came back, he brought in this box. I want to talk about this box for a moment because I have one like it. And I'm guessing that some of you do too. Do you have a box where you put like keepsakes, mementos, special things? For me, it's a little brown wooden box that says San Diego on the front. I got it when I was a kid on a trip to San Diego. And, you know, I have to admit, I haven't seen this box in a couple years. It's in a storage unit in Austin, Texas, where I pastored. I was the founding pastor of Calvary Austin, pastored there for 18 years. And I know that box is in that storage unit. And inside that box is like my high school class ring and some coins I gathered in travels around the world and probably some other unimportant things that have found their way into that box over time. But I know it's there. Do you have a box like that? Anybody? A place where you put stuff like that? Yeah. So my dad brought out Grandpa's box. He carefully took the lid off and started moving things around inside the box and then taking things out one at a time. He took out a document that was related to one of my grandparents' divorces. And then he took out a picture of my grandfather with my uncle Bill on his knee when Bill was a baby. Bill was later killed in action in Vietnam. And then my dad pulled out my kindergarten picture and my first grade picture and my second grade picture. I was blown away. And I have to admit, I felt kind of conflicted. There was a part of me that felt really, really good that I made Grandpa's box. That even though I can barely remember his face, he thought that my face had a place in his box. But there was another part of me that felt really, really bad. And that was the part of me that realized that whereas my box, and I'm guessing your box too, is a box that's filled with memories, his was a box filled with regrets. His was a box filled with reminders of all the things that he had but lost, all the things that he might have enjoyed right up until the end of his life, but instead didn't get to enjoy at all. And so whether we're talking about my grandfather's story or whether we're talking about this Bible backstory, there has to come a time in our lives when we say enough is enough. When we say that no matter what it is that's gone on, no matter how long it's gone on, no matter if we ourselves have struggled in this same way as I have, that it stops here, it stops now, it stops with this generation, it stops with us, it stops with me. Can you feel the mood in Acacia Grove? Now, another similar observation, and that is how Joshua sends these two spies in. See, that too takes us back a generation. Because Moses sent spies in, except Moses sent 12 spies. And if you know the story, you know that 10 of those spies came back with a negative report. They were like, there is no way we can conquer the land. I don't care who God says we are. I don't care what God says we can do. There is no way. We can't do it. We shouldn't even try to do it. Now, there were two guys who came back with a positive report. One of those is Joshua, by the way. And they came back and they're like, oh, we still got this. Like, we are exactly who God says we are. We can do exactly what God says we can do. Why are we having this conversation? We're wasting time. We should be taking the land right now. And sadly, as is often the case, even in a community of faith like a local church, the negative voices carried the day. And as a result, an entire generation was doomed to die in the wilderness. Their sentence? Their sentence was 40 years with time served. For the best part of 40 years, they would wander through the desert waiting for everyone of a certain age to die. I mean, let's just think about this for a minute. If there were 1.2 million adults, and that's a conservative estimate, and if they used every single hour of daylight to bury people, then that means funerals year after year, month after month, week after week, day after day, hour after hour, about 7 or 8 times per hour, they were burying someone for 40 years. And you know that every single time another body slid beneath the sand, that they were reminded of what happens when we listen to the wrong voices. When we listen to anyone who says anything other than what God says about who we are and about what we can do. Now, maybe that's been your experience. I mean, for some people, that's been their whole life. Listening to a negative story about themselves from other people. It could have been, for you, it might have been a parent. It could have been a sibling. It could have been a teacher or a coach. It could have been a youth pastor or a Sunday school teacher. In your adult life, it could be like a coworker or an employer. It could even be your spouse. But for as long as you can remember, you've been beat down by the negative words of another person or group of people. And if that's been your experience, I am so sorry, because that can be really hard to overcome. But isn't it true that for all of us, those that can relate to that and those that cannot, for all of us, our biggest problem isn't with the story that they tell us about us, but with the story that we tell ourselves? Have you spent a lifetime telling yourself that you're not enough? I'm not tall enough. I'm not handsome enough. I'm not beautiful enough. I'm not fast enough. I'm not athletic enough. I'm not, you know, creative enough. I'm not skilled enough. I'm not educated enough. I'm not cool enough. I'm not sophisticated enough. I'm not spiritual enough. It's one more of those things where there has to come a time in our lives when we say, enough is enough. That going forward, we're not going to listen to anyone, even if it's us, who says anything other than what God says about who we are and about what we can do. Can you feel the mood in Acacia Grove? And so it's in this context that they're ready to take this next step. The spies, well, they were told to gather intelligence, especially about a place called Jericho. Now, Jericho, on their website, the modern city of Jericho claims to be one of the oldest continuously inhabited cities in the world. Now, what we are interested in is what was Jericho like in ancient times, right? What was Jericho like in Bible times? And so maybe one of the first things we need to know, one of the most important things we need to know about ancient Jericho is that it was heavily fortified with not one but two walls. Apparently, the king of Jericho promised voters that if elected, he would build a wall and Moab would pay for it. I don't know. But so they had a wall. Now, in all seriousness, in ancient times, a wall was a matter of security. In ancient times, a wall was the difference between a good night's sleep and getting killed in your sleep. Your wife raped, your kids taken as slaves. I mean, that was life in ancient Jericho. But what would happen in an ancient city if after you'd built a wall, you ran out of space? Well, then you come in and you build another wall. So picture a second larger concentric circle and the space between the walls, suburbs. Like old Jericho and new Jericho. Now just file that away because we're going to come back to it. But the spies, no sooner did their feet hit the ground in Jericho than they are found in the red light district. What? I mean, if you were new to the Bible, you would so not see that coming. There's no way you would guess that you'd turn the page and that's where you'd find these spies. We go in a split second from talking about the world's oldest city to talking about the world's oldest profession. But before you get the wrong idea, I don't believe the spies were at Rahab's place to get under the covers. I believe they were there undercover. You know, as we think about it, as they were traveling that day, the success of their mission depended upon not drawing attention to themselves. It's likely that they entered the city as part of a larger group and they followed the tourists to the parts of the city where tourists went. But we also shouldn't underestimate the potential value that they might have placed in Rahab as an intelligence asset. I mean, think of it. There's no telling who she knew or what. It was totally reasonable for them to think that Rahab might actually have access to information that no one else they were going to get to talk to would have access to. So it makes perfect sense that they would want to talk to someone like Rahab. All that to say that if there was anything at all inappropriate about their visit to Rahab's place, the Bible doesn't tell us so. But I love, love, love that the Bible tells us the truth about Rahab. I love that for so many reasons that like could be its own message with multiple points. I just want to share one with you. Let me just pick one of those reasons and touch on it briefly. It seems to me like today we're hearing lots of buzzwords in the church like authenticity, transparency, vulnerability. In some gatherings of church leaders, there's talk about creating safe space for people to practice authenticity and so forth. The problem is that we're so much better at talking about this stuff than we are at doing it. If you've been doing church for long, as I have, you know, meaning that this is not your first church home. You've probably had several church homes over your lifetime, and you were somewhere at some point when someone got brave. Someone found their voice. They told their story, like Miranda did tonight. Maybe they talked about their struggles or admitted to having some doubts. And then you watched in horror as the people around them shamed them, shushed them, and shunned them. And you learn very quickly that church is not always a safe place to keep it real, no matter what we say. But wouldn't you agree that it should be? I mean, wouldn't we all think when we read things like this, when we read the truth about Rahab, wouldn't we think that church would be a place where we could be authentic and transparent and vulnerable? So if and when we find ourselves in a place where that's not the culture, I think we could change the culture. I don't think we have to wait for somebody at the top to figure it out. I think we can make a change happen ourselves. I think that if we all agreed to do two things, we could change that. One is we have to get brave. We have to tell our story. And then two, when other people get brave and tell their story, we have to refuse to be a part of the group that would otherwise shame, shush, or shun them. I mean, imagine if an entire group of people were to decide that they were going to go all in on that. It would make a huge difference, right? Now, in fairness to Rahab, she may have done what she did as a matter of survival. Am I saying that what Rahab did was okay? No, what Rahab did was not okay. Just like many things that I have done are not okay. But again, the ancient world was so different. I mean, I was kidding a minute ago about a campaign issue that we heard so much about last year and really are still hearing about. Another thing we heard about last year in the campaign trail was equal pay. And I'm so glad that we're hearing about that. I mean, I think most people would agree that we've made a ton of progress in that regard, but that we still have work to do. So it's good that we're talking about that. But oh my, in the ancient world, I mean, if you were a single woman in ancient Jericho and you weren't married and you didn't have a family helping with your financial needs, you were in a really bad place. It's not like Rahab could just put her career hat on and reinvent herself. She couldn't just log into LinkedIn and start networking. You know, the ancient world didn't work that way. And so a lot of times in the ancient world, and maybe more often than we suppose in the modern world, there have been women so desperate to find a way to survive another day, another week, another month, that they've thought about doing things or even done things that they never would have dreamed of doing. All this to say a couple things. One is, however upsetting it is for us to learn this about her, and it is upsetting, right? I mean, it should upset us to learn this about her. But however upsetting it is for us to learn this about her, it's not half as upsetting as it was for her to live it. And the other thing I'm saying is, maybe I should put it as a question. Aren't we learning that life is so much better when we take even 5 minutes to put ourselves in someone else's shoes before we decide that they don't matter, that they don't count, that they don't have any value, or even that we know everything about what they're doing or why they're doing it? Because, in fact, we never do. Could Rahab live heroically? Well, not unless she let go of the past. Think of all the guilt from Rahab's past. Think of all the guys, all the hookups. Do you have a past? Are there skeletons in your closet? I mean, the truth is, we've all done things that we're ashamed of. We've all done things that we're embarrassed by. We've all done things that we deeply regret. But one of the biggest mistakes that we can make in life is if we allow guilt from our past to rob us of the future that God has for us. And you know why we do that? You know why we let guilt from our past rob us like that? It's because we don't get forgiveness. I don't mean that we haven't received it. If you're a follower of Christ, you've received forgiveness. But what I mean is we don't get it up here. What I mean is we struggle to wrap our minds around the idea that God has forgiven us. Or as we sometimes say, that God forgives and forgets. Think of that verse in the Old Testament where it says that God takes our sin and dumps it into the sea. That's a great verse. I want you to get a visual on this, okay? God is rounding up. He's gathering up all of my sin. He's gathering up all of Alan Riggs' sin. Get comfortable. This could take a while. Wait for it. Wait. Okay, he's got it. Now he's dumping it into the Mediterranean Sea. I want you to picture the storm surge. Beaches all around the Mediterranean are disappearing. Coastal cities are being covered with water as my sin is dropping down into the dark depths of the sea, surrounded by a bubble field. Finally, my sin, it hits the seabed, sending silt in every direction, and only slowly does the silt settle until finally my sin is completely covered, and no one can find it, and no one's ever going to dredge it up, not even God himself, because he promises not to. With that image in mind, do you think there could ever come a time when I am allowing guilt from our past to rob us of the future that God has for us, that God might say to us, I'm over it, why aren't you? Have you allowed a handful of guilty memories to control your life, to define you, to tell you who you are? It's one more of those things where we have to say enough is enough. That going forward, we're not going to live from that guilty place anymore. That we're going to live from that forgiven place instead. Now, I think for Rahab, there was not only the guilt from the past, I think there was hurt from the past. I think she'd had a falling out with her family. We're going to learn a little bit later in the chapter that she did have family in Jericho. So, admittedly, this is speculative on my part, but humor me. Is it not at least possible, if she had family in Jericho, and if, as best we can tell, they were not helping her financially, as best we can tell, they were not trying in any way to rescue her from the lifestyle that she was caught up in, as best we can tell, they had nothing to do with her, she had nothing to do with them, is it not at least possible that they'd had a falling out? That she was hurt? That they were hurt? They were probably both hurt. There's probably more than enough hurt to go around. There usually is, right? Have you been hurt? Is there anger? Is there bitterness? Is there resentment in your life? I mean, the truth is that we've all been hurt. And you know why hurt from our past robs us of the future that God has for us? It's because we don't give forgiveness. So guilt robs us because we don't get forgiveness. Hurt robs us because we don't give it. You've probably heard that saying, hurt people hurt people. It's really true. And you and I, we try to hurt the people who've hurt us by being all like this. Like, no, I'm not going to forgive you. You owe me. You owe it to me to be miserable for the rest of your life. You know, it gets so bad that we're laying in bed, awake, in the middle of the night. We're not counting sheep. We're telling ourselves stories like this one, like, oh, I hope I never see them again. No, I hope I do, because I've got a thing or two to say to them. What if I ran into them like at the grocery store, the hardware store? I'd act like I didn't even know them. That'd be good. Well, no, because I've got these zingers I've been working on, so I'd have to acknowledge them. So I'd go up to them and I'd say this, and they'd be speechless. That'd be good. Well, no, because I got more zingers, so they'd have to respond. So I would say this, and they'd say that, and it'd be really stupid, so then I'd say this. Meanwhile, here they are at home. I mean, they don't even know that we're thinking that stuff. Or worse, they know, and they totally do not care. This is why we say that forgiveness is a gift that we give ourselves. When I forgive someone, it effectively ends any control that they have over my life. Now I get it. I do. I get it. If you've been hurt recently, or if you've been hurt deeply, this is the last thing you want to hear. You're like, who is this guy? I came here tonight to sing the songs and pray the prayers. I thought I was going to hear something kind of inspiring. And instead, this guy's telling me I have to forgive. He doesn't know what they did. He doesn't know what happened to me. I totally understand that. Maybe it would help if I explained the difference between two things, one of which I'm talking about and one of which I'm not. There's a world of difference between forgiveness, which I am talking about, and reconciliation, which I'm not talking about. It takes two to reconcile. For that reason alone, reconciliation isn't always possible. Now, you'll hear that frequently in church. Can I tell you something that you won't hear as frequently? This is like director's cut. This is like when you buy the DVD, you know, when it drops and it's got the extra stuff in it. So here's a little bit of extra. Not only is reconciliation not always possible, but it isn't always, not always desirable. You take a story like Miranda's, where reconciliation would not have been safe for her or for our daughter. But while it takes two people to reconcile, it takes one to forgive. You can, I can decide all by ourselves to just let go of this sense that someone owes us this relational debt. Now again, the pushback could be something like this. It could be like, yeah, but if I forgive them, then I'm saying that what they did wasn't wrong. I'm saying that what they did didn't hurt. No, that's not what you'd be saying. Here's what you'd be saying. You'd be saying what they did was wrong, what they did hurt, but holding this relational IOU over their head is tearing me up, so I'm tearing it up. I refuse to lose even one more day of my life to this sense of angst over this unresolved relational debt. Have you allowed a handful of hurtful memories to control your life, to define you? To tell you who you are? This is one more of those things where we can say enough is enough, that going forward, we're not going to live from that hurt place anymore. We're going to live from this forgiving place instead. And so the idea is to let go of the past. It's to let go of past guilt. It's to let go of past hurt. If we're going to live heroically, we have to do that. You know what else we have to do? We have to face our fears. So let's go back to our Bibles, picking it up in verse 2. We're going to start moving a little more quickly. And it was told the king of Jericho, saying, "Behold, men have come here tonight from the children of Israel to search out the country." So the king of Jericho sent to Rahab, saying, "Bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the country." Then the woman took the two men and hid them. So she said, "Yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from." And it happened as the gate was being shut when it was dark that the men went out. Where the men went, I do not know. Pursue them quickly, for you may overtake them. But she had brought them up to the roof and hidden them with the stalks of flax which she had laid in order on the roof. Then the men pursued them by the road to the Jordan to the fords. And as soon as those who pursued them had gone out, they shut the gate. So apparently the spies had been followed. They'd been found out. Could Rahab live heroically? Well, not unless she faced her fears. Now fear, I mean, fear is so universal, isn't it? I mean, when I talk about fear, I know I'm talking to everybody on some level, to some degree. Have you guys seen that website, phobialist.com? You'll have to check it out. There's over 500 phobias cataloged there. It's like you're scared of stuff you hadn't even thought of yet. It's crazy. Anybody here afraid of heights? Yeah, so you're not even lifting your hand all the way up over your head because that would be like too far off the ground. Anybody here have like an unnatural fear of needles? Nobody likes needles, but it freaks some of us out more than others. Anybody have like an unnatural fear of spiders? Spiders are not great, right? Who's afraid to raise their hand in public? Okay, you pass. There's probably some cold water, maybe coffee in the lobby somewhere. You guys can relax. The rest of us have more work to do, however. I mean, again, talking about fear and how crazy it is, I'm thinking of this picture that was taken of my adult daughter, Lauren, when she was a kid. Now, Lauren's 25. She's the new mom. She is the children's ministry director at Calvary Chapel, Tallahassee. So proud of her. But you know, when she was a young girl, she was terrified of people in costumes, which is why I thought it was a really bad idea the year she wanted to celebrate her birthday at Chuck E. Cheese, where the whole point is to have a person in a costume come and greet the birthday girl. So the picture I'm thinking of, the moment it was taken, was the moment that the rat was stalking the birthday girl. So Chucky's coming in, for a hug. Lauren is just beside herself. She's jumped into my arms. She's got her arms around Daddy. I've got my arms around Lauren. Her eyes, bigger than the pizzas on the table, man. It was unbelievable. Whether it was Lauren's childhood fear of people in costumes or my nearly crippling fear of a coffee shortage, we've all got stuff that completely freaks us out. I mean, let's break fear down for a minute. Have you ever been so scared that you did something you wouldn't normally do? I totally have. Have you ever been so scared that you didn't do something you normally would do? I've totally done that too. That's powerful, right? To influence us that much, to have that much control over us. And maybe that's why the most common command in the Bible is do not be afraid. Did you know that? I mean, there's more than a few do's and don'ts in the Bible. But the one that appears more than any other, in fact, over 300 times, is do not be afraid. Now, here's the thing. I mean, I've sort of been creating this physical timeline, talking about guilt and hurt over here in our past. When we talk about fear, we usually think of that as being over here in our future, right? But don't make the mistake of thinking that they're unrelated because they're not unrelated. You know what I'm learning? I'm learning that in life, if I don't make peace with the past, I will almost always fear the future. And Rahab, she had every reason to be afraid. She was about to risk her life to hide the spies and to lie for them. Whoa. That raises an ethical issue, doesn't it? Was it okay or was it not okay for Rahab to lie for the spies? Now, we can disagree about this and be friends, but I want to just give you a real quick take. I would compare what Rahab did to what people living in Europe during World War II did. People who took Jews into their homes and who hid them. People who sometimes built safe space in which they could hide. And then when Nazi soldiers came knocking on the door and demanding to know whether there were Jews present, they lied. They said no. They chose life-saving over truth-telling when it wasn't possible to do both. Two absolute moral obligations came into unavoidable conflict, and they chose the greater good, and I believe they did so without guilt. So that's the way I see the Rahab story as well. Now, like I said, we can disagree about that and be friends, but one thing to consider, let's just say we had, God forbid, an active shooter situation right now, and let's say that you took cover behind one of these curtains, and the shooter said to me, "Is there anyone else here?" I would say no and take my chances. But let's reverse the roles. Let's say that I had taken cover behind the curtain and you're here and they ask you, is there anyone else here? And you're going to say, yeah, Rig just went backstage. If you hurry, you might catch him. So you ought to feel really good about hanging out with me, but me with you, I don't know. Well, in all seriousness, Rahab, I mean, she could have played it safe, right? Have you ever done that? Have you ever played it safe only to regret it later? Sure you have. Remember that time you struck out looking? And all these years later, you're still like, oh, if only I'd taken a cut at that pitch. Or what about that time you knew the answer, but you like literally could not get your voice to come out of your throat? Or that time that you wanted to sign up and you just couldn't bring yourself to put pen to paper and put your name on a list? What about that time you couldn't make up your mind about the house or the car and someone else got it? Or that one time, you know the time I mean, when you were so close to telling someone how you really felt about them, but you chickened out. And maybe you never had another chance. Rahab could have played it safe. She could have refused to hide the spies. She could have refused to lie for them. Instead, she risked the life she had, the only life she knew, for the life that she wanted. To live heroically, you have to do that, and that's scary. That's why we have to face our fears. Now, I can imagine the pushback on this point, too. You might be like, you're talking about, you know, taking risks, and I'm not a risk taker. Do I look like a risk taker? Have you met me? You know, maybe you would describe yourself as having a low risk tolerance or maybe no risk tolerance. Now, here's the thing. I'm not buying it. Not so long ago, I was in a bookstore. You guys remember those? They had shelves and these things with pages in them. They were really cool. I liked them a lot. I took this one book off the shelf, and I was looking at the spine at the title, and it said, The 100 Most Dangerous Things in Everyday Life and What to Do About Them. Do not read that book. That book wrecked my mind. I mean, I didn't know that every year in the United States, more people are killed by teddy bears than by grizzly bears. Seriously, like you can have a button come off, you can have a choking incident. I mean, who knew? Every year in the United States, 40,000 people are injured watching television, or at least by their television set. I have to admit that more than once, we've been watching America's Funniest Videos, AFV, and we've seen like a couple of kids roughhousing, and they roll into a piece of furniture that starts to wobble, a TV tumbles off, and then you have like a crushing injury. Did you know that every year in the United States, 60,000 people are injured using the toilet? Yeah, I know. So don't tell me you're not a risk taker. Unless you're prepared to hold it forever. The question is not whether to risk, but what. So listen, will you risk the life you have for the life you want, the life that God wants for you? Or are you going to risk the life that you want, the life that God wants for you, to hold on to the life that you have? The idea is to face your fears. What are you afraid of? What would you do tomorrow if you weren't afraid? And the verses that we're about to read, like verse 9, Rahab uses fear words like terror and faint-hearted. In verse 11, she uses fear phrases like our hearts melted and neither did there remain any courage. And yet when we read about Rahab in the New Testament, it says nothing about her fear and everything about her faith. This totally like contradicts one of the things that we believe about heroism. In our minds, a hero is someone who doesn't feel fear, but Rahab was so scared. So Rahab teaches us something so important, so fundamental to you and me learning to live heroically, and that is that it's not that heroes don't feel fear, they do. It's just that they're not controlled by it. So for you and me as followers of Christ, we're going to feel fear and maybe even more so simply because God loves us way too much to let us stay comfortable for long. He's always pushing us out of our comfort zone. He's always putting us in awkward and uncomfortable places out of love for us because he wants so much more for us. But despite the fact that we're going to feel at least as much fear as anyone else, we don't have to be controlled by it. That's a game changer. Imagine thoughts not fueled by fear. Imagine future plans not formed in fear. Imagine a life that's not just completely controlled by fear. And so, again, to live heroically, we have to let go of the past. We have to face our fears. And finally, the third thing, we have to believe. Look with me at verse 8. It says, Now before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land. that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who are on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. Neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Now therefore, I beg you, swear to me by the Lord, since I have shown you kindness, that you also will show kindness to my father's house, to give me a true token, and spare my father, my mother, my brothers, my sisters, and all that they have, and deliver our lives from death. Now, we've got some more verses to read, but quickly, let your eyes fall on verse 11. I want to draw your attention to what Rahab said. She spoke of one God, singular. She spoke of a personal God when she used the pronoun your God. She spoke of an all-powerful, everywhere present at once God when she described him as, quote, in heaven above and on earth beneath, end quote. This is the language of faith. I believe that Rahab had come to faith. So picking it up in verse 14, the men answered her, our lives for yours, if none of you tell this business of ours, then it shall be when the Lord has given us the land that we will deal kindly and truly with you. Then she let them down by a rope through the window, for her house was on the city wall. She dwelt on the wall. And she said to them, get to the mountain, lest the pursuers meet you. Hide there 3 days until the pursuers have returned. Afterwards, you may go your way. So the men said to her, we'll be blameless of this oath of yours, which you made us swear, unless when we come into the land, you bind this line of scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down, and unless you bring your father, mother, brothers, and all your father's household to your own home. So it shall be that whoever goes outside the doors of your house into the street, his blood shall be in his own head, and we'll be guiltless. And whoever is with you in the house, his blood shall be on our head if a hand is laid on him. And if you tell this business of ours, then we will be free from your oath, which you made us swear. Then she said, according to your words, so be it. And she sent them away, and they departed. And she bound the scarlet cord in the window. Now, notice, in verse 15, it says not once but twice that Rahab lived on the city wall. So, I want you to imagine that you and I, we are on the approach to Jericho, okay? And we can see the inner wall, but we're interested in that outer wall. Now, I'm just going to tell you right now, if you go home and you Google the walls of Jericho, you know, you can listen to sermons, you can read blogs, you can watch documentaries, you can pull a commentary off your shelf, you can read the notes in your study Bible. They are not all going to agree on exactly what these walls looked like or their exact dimensions. The Bible doesn't tell us that. But my research gives me the idea that it might have looked something like this. This outer wall would have been like a 15-foot earthen retaining wall, and then on top of that, like a 25-foot brick wall. So come on, you and I, we're walking. We're approaching that wall. And we're walking right up underneath Rahab's window. And as we stand looking up at it, we're looking up like 40 feet. Which raises a question. What in the world was Rahab doing with a 40 or 50-foot rope laying around the house? I mean, did everybody in Jericho keep a 50-footer in the coffee table? Did only people who live along the wall keep a rope on a hook by the window? I don't know, but I'm guessing these were not the first men who had to make a hasty escape from Rahab's place. Just throwing that out there. She was not letting them go anywhere, though, until she had a deal with them. Which raises a much better question than the rope question, as entertaining as that is to me. Why didn't she go with them? I mean, she could have led them to a cave in the hill country of Judah. And then when it was safe, she could have followed them to Acacia Grove. What if they didn't come back? Or what if they came back and didn't keep their word, broke the deal? Or what if before they could come back and keep the deal, she'd been found out? They would have killed her for sure. There's only one reason. There's only one reason that I can find anywhere in this text. And that's her family. That family. That family that, as best we can tell, had little or nothing to do with her. That family that apparently was not helping her financially. That a family that apparently had given up, if they had ever tried at all, to get her out of that lifestyle. Yeah, that family. Could Rahab live heroically? Not unless she believed. Not unless she believed in God, which we saw in verse 11. She had come to believe in God. Not unless she believed in herself, by which I mean the woman that God was making her. And not unless she came to believe in the future, by which I mean the future that God was forming for her, but not for her alone, for her and for others around her. This is an amazing thing because she had so many reasons not to care about anyone's future but her own. We've learned tonight that she'd been overlooked by the eligible bachelors of Jericho. She'd been used by immoral men from far and wide. She'd apparently been abandoned by her own family. Who would blame her for wanting to get out and never look back? But the idea is to believe God for a big future that makes us and others bigger. As Christians, man, we love talking about future things. I mean, we love talking about like vision. We've got vision for our family and vision for our work. We've got vision at church, vision for our ministry. Sometimes we talk about having like a God-given dream for this or that thing. So hear what I'm saying. If your God-given dream is only big enough for you, that is not God's dream for you. God's dream for you will always be so big that there's room in it for you and for others. And Rahab is the most amazing case in point. By the time you get to chapter 6 and you read about the Battle of Jericho, you find that she and her family were spared. And then just two verses later, we find out that when the book of Joshua was written, Rahab was alive and well and living as a part of their community. How awesome is that? Not half as good as this, because you get to the end of the Old Testament. And then you turn through those blank pages between the Testaments. And then you turn to the first book of the New Testament. And the first chapter of the first book. And the first verses of the first chapter. And there you find a tree. But not just any tree. A family tree. And not even just any family tree. It's Jesus' family tree. Now, I have to describe it for you because it has these huge branches going off in every direction. And on each branch is carved the name of a woman or a man who lived heroically. And on one branch, for all the world to see, for me to see, for you tonight to take to heart, is carved R-A-H-A-B. You know what that means, right? That means that not only had Rahab, you know, become a part of their community, but it means that she'd fallen in love. It means that she'd gotten married. It means that she had kids who had kids who had kids until finally one of her descendants was Jesus, God in the flesh. The Savior of the world, who many rightly see in the color of the cord that she was asked to tie in her window, the scarlet cord, suggesting, they would say, the blood that Jesus would later shed to make all this cool stuff that we're talking about possible. Oh my goodness. I mean, clearly Rahab had an ability that blows our minds to believe God for a bigger, better future. But do you think that even Rahab could have foreseen this? From prostitute to mother. How long had Rahab worn that prostitute label? You know, for how long had that label been there? Prostitute. And God just comes along and takes hold of the corner and listen, rip! And in its place puts a new label that says, mother. You heard a little bit of Miranda's story tonight. I didn't share as much of my own personal story tonight, but we have similar stories, similar experiences. You know, we both